May it please the court, counsel. NMA's, I'm going to limit my comments to the remarks in NMA's brief, but NMA does agree with Marg that the case could be resolved on the separate grounds that Mr. Chiat is going to speak to on behalf of Marg. NMA's petition was brought because MSHA has engaged in a bait and switch, and this court should not allow it. Now, this latest...
those are fighting words, aren't they?
Well, this is the latest chapter, Your Honor, in the long arc of the DPM rulemaking saga. And in 2006, when we were before the court in the Kennecott-Greens Creek case, MSHA told the court, we are going to promulgate an elemental carbon standard, elemental carbon as a surrogate for the DPM.
Let me ask you, the government took the position that there were several ways the court could approach this case. The court took one approach that sustained what the agency had proposed. At that point, are you saying the agency's not entitled to reexamine what they're going to do next?
Well, is the question about what the court said or about what MSHA is allowed to do after the court's decision?
The latter.
Well, MSHA told the court,
we're beyond that. The court has ruled.
But we cannot decouple the court's decision from MSHA's assurance that, oh, by the way, you don't even have to examine the merits of the 160 TC rule.
Can you point us to any language in that decision which makes the affirmance of the rule contingent upon MSHA's proceeding with the proposed inquiry?
I cannot point you to language, but that's the problem, is that the assurance was given.
Doesn't that mean that the affirmance of the rule was independent of the promise?
Well, we don't know that, because that assurance was given, and MSHA can't take
back. But if that's the, I mean, this court knows how to make things contingent, right? And it seemed to me there was nothing in that decision which made the outcome contingent on the promise, if that's the right word for it.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that the court upheld the merits of the 160 total carbon standard. Our position is
that sort of ends it right there when you make that concession.
Well, it
that's I, it because res- that's the way I read it too. And since it upheld it, that's it.
I would respectfully submit to you, Your Honor, that it doesn't for two reasons.
Why?
Well, the first is that we cannot be in the minds and the heads of the previous panel and know.
You don't have to be. You can just read the opinion. It as you said, you just read it and it sustained the 160 standard.
And said at the same time, in any event, MSHA has no intent of using TC as a standalone proxy.
But it didn't say we find the 160 standard not arbitrary and capricious because the agencies agreed to abandon it. This court knows how to say that.
Well,
we didn't.
Your Honor, you're right that literally taken, that's not what the court said.
Well, that's how we interpret the opinion, literally.
Let me address the second point why I think that is not fatal here is because if you look at what MSHA did on May 20th, not only did it rescind its long-promised effort to create a elemental carbon standard, it also published what it called a program policy letter, which gave further compliance issues into the 160 TC standard, and a couple days later,
Your argument that it should have been subject to notice and comment, right?
Well, actually, I was uncertain as to whether you were making such an argument because it seemed to me that that's quite a complex argument. And although there are allusions to it, I don't see such an argument formally being made.
Well, we challenged as part of our petition both the rescission and the publication of the PPL.
Yeah, but we're in your brief.
But is there a claim that the PPL must be preceded by notice and comment rulemaking?
Well, certainly there is.
In your brief?
It seemed to me your notice and comment arguments were directed to the decision to allow the extant rule to go into effect.
Well, we address both points, both in our petition, in our brief, and in our reply. And
I saw it definitely in your reply.
Well, that's where we were elaborating on it, because MSHA was taking us.
Where is it in the blue brief?
In particular,
we have cases on this subject, the most noteworthy of which, in your favor, is Appalachian Power, which you don't cite.
We do.
No, okay, I'm sorry.
I cite it somewhere.
We do, and first of all, I'll reference.
Not in your blue brief.
Well, I'll reference you to page 29, footnote 7, and then certainly in the reply brief, to elaborate on the argument.
Yeah,
we cite it at page 23.
But just focus on the blue brief for a minute, because
okay.
If the argument isn't there, you can't elaborate it. You can't elaborate on it in your reply.
Well, Your Honor, the issue was put into the question was put into issue in our petition, and
no,
MSHA.
But you have to argue it in your brief.
Well, we did argue it in our brief.
Judge Williams just asked you where.
Line 2 of footnote 7, again with no opportunity for notice and comment.
I'm referencing.
That just doesn't cut it at all in terms of raising an argument.
Well, I would suggest. Well, I.
And the reason I focus on it,
that it does.
This is a very difficult area. And if one is to raise an argument along those lines, it requires serious briefing.
Well, Your Honor.
There's not something you toss off with a prepositional phrase.
Well, the point to our position was that these two things were happening simultaneously. That an event happened on May 20th that had two effects. One was to rescind the effort to go forward on elemental carbon, and at the same time to elaborate on the existing rule. And I would just point your attention to the PPL and the air factors, both of which are in the record. And if you look, for example, at Joint Appendix page 1567, you see an elaboration on how to enforce and come into compliance with the 160 TC standard. And I submit to you that all of this, whatever its merits, is part of the rule itself, because it affects the obligations and rights of mine operators and needs to go through notice and comment.
You may have a good claim that the PPL should have been subject to notice and comment rulemaking, but I don't see that you made it. Certainly, in footnote 7 is the closest you can come. It's nowhere near close enough.
Well, Your Honor, our briefs speak for themselves, and I need to respect what you're telling me. And if I could go back to the rescission point for just a moment.
Yeah, when you state the issues for us in your brief, it's all about abandoning the promised rulemaking.
Well, I can't say anything more than I have. I mean, the point is, as was made clear from the petition forward, this was all the nucleus of operative facts. You know, involved both of these key issues, and both were at issue. And I would submit that MSHA's own briefing of it signals that they were aware that we were challenging them on the PPL, because they devoted a portion of their brief to that. In response to our opening brief. And on the rescission point, the key point to be
An
made...
understandable caution.
What?
I understand, but I think the record is fully made and that this court could rule on our argument on the PPL. Now, on the rescission part, the key point to be made is that MSHA has relied in backing away from its elemental carbon standard on a study which its own authors say doesn't really help all that much, because it was limited to 4 mines and provides a limited data set. It says more data are necessary to understand this. It practically invites further research. And now I submit to you that if MSHA had reached this conclusion back in 2006, we would have had a chance to comment on that study. It would have been part of the record. And the parties would have briefed the issues accordingly. And MSHA would not have been able to have that fallback position that, oh, by the way, let's carve out the final consideration of the final rule because we're going to get to a new rulemaking in the future. MSHA, what they've done is they've punted that issue, which is part of the same arc of DPM rulemaking, down the road. And we should be able
to... I take it that the 2007 decision... upheld the rule against a facial attack, right? Period, full stop. so that so far as the rule as applied, that is still open. All the more so because of the PPL. Well, I will ask the same question of MSHA counsel.
You want me to respond? I see my time is...
Go ahead, yes, please.
Well, the I don't want to
I assume you think that to be the case.
Well, it again, this takes us back to what the court was thinking in 2006.
No, it doesn't take us to what the court was thinking. It takes us to what the court decision did.
Well, it upheld the 160 TC rule.
Against a facial attack, which was the only attack that could have been launched against it, right?
With the understanding that, frankly, it would be moot before it was ever effective.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Chayette?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Henry Chayette on behalf of the MARGE Coalition of Companies that for 20 years has sought to obtain sound science and transparency and law compliance from NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and MSHA in the study and regulation of diesel exhaust. Your Honors, the NIOSH role in mine safety is very specific in 30 U.S.C. Section 811. This is not a statute like others that are addressed by the Department of Labor and HHS. This statute gives NIOSH a direct role in rulemaking. It says in 811A6B, uses the word shall three times in addressing NIOSH's role.
That was true in the Bangor case, too, with respect to the Interior Department. And we held in that case that Interior was not a proper party.
In this case, Your Honor, the right of review and the establishment of jurisdiction for this court first is exclusive and then says that it's a right of review for the standard. It doesn't limit the right of review to the Mine Safety and Health Administration.
Doesn't? No, but it limits it to to mandatory health and safety standards. That's what we're reviewing, and the only agency that can issue those is the Mine Health and Safety Administration.
That is correct, Your Honor. MSHA issues the standard, but NIOSH is required by the statute on a continuous basis to determine if there are potential toxics.
That's why I asked you about the Bangor case.
I think the Bangor case.
In the Bangor case, the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, had no flexibility. It had to include the Interior Department's condition. It was required by statute to include it in the order. Yet we ruled that it couldn't be sued. Only FERC could be.
The Bangor
case,
Your Honor, my understanding...
The case is exactly in point.
My understanding of that statute is specific. It says a written petition praying that the order of the commission be modified.
Right. So it mentions the commission, but it ruled that even though the commission had to include Interior's exception or condition, Interior could not be sued. And this case says the only thing that can be challenged is a mandatory health and safety standard. That's all.
It creates a jurisdiction for this court to review the standard, to review inherently the actions leading or to the standard. It doesn't limit review to the orders of MSHA, as in the Bangor case.
We can review the evidence that the agency relied on. You're absolutely right. But the question I'm asking you is, you've sued HHS and this National Institute, and the question is, can you do that?
I think we're required to under the exclusivity provisions of the review standard in this law. It says that this is the exclusive remedy for the challenging of those standards. I don't think we have a choice.
Suppose that MSHA had relied on a private study. W- would that mean that the institute or whatever that had issued the private study would be a proper party to the lawsuit?
I don't believe a private study takes
the
place.
How is this materially different?
Well, this is the United States government spending.
But an independent branch of it, and simply one that can be a source of information, like a private institute.
It's more, Your Honor, under the terms of the statute, it's very much more. This agency is given very specific mandatory duties in rulemaking under Section 101 of the Mine Act. When this court is given jurisdiction to review the results of that rulemaking, and that agency did not release for 20 years its product, which the statute orders them to do, and which a district court has ordered them to do.
Well, I mean, nothing that we say would have anything to do with the merits of your claim in the Fifth Circuit.
I appreciate
that. That may be terrific.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, but I think there is law that we cite that says that you can exercise jurisdiction concurrent with.
Those are cases where the suit is against the same section of government, the same agency. The statute has somewhat mysteriously provided that one type of appeal goes direct to the Court of Appeals, the other goes up through the district court, and we sort of made a slight end run around that statutory system. But you're asking that the end run be expanded enormously.
I respectfully disagree that it's an end run, because this statute is very different. And it gives precise language, express language. The intent of Congress was to review mandatory standards. We were given an exclusive remedy in this court in the review of those mandatory standards.
Got it.
And NIOSH is given an express role to continuously report and to provide, shall submit to the Secretary, all pertinent criteria. Their affidavits themselves have demonstrated to this court that they've spent millions of dollars, have thousands of data points, all put together, ready to go. And that has not been delivered. It's a clear violation.
You may ultimately have a remedy against it under the APA, if it ever takes final action that's reviewable. But
Or delays.
You could mandamus them, but that doesn't seem to me to be responsive to this, to the statute, and the fact that our review is limited to these final health and safety standards. So,
or the failure to conform with the law in the promulgation of those standards.
Correct. That's absolutely right.
And it's that failure to conform to the statute.
That's OSHA's failure to conform, if it's anybody's.
Right.
Under 811, the express provisions of that statute, Your Honor, it's also the NIOSH failure. There are multiple shalls used in that language. It's not discretionary. It's mandatory. And the agency has failed to comply with its rulemaking duties under 811. The review provision in this act is very specific. It says actions, mandatory standards under this section, including all of 811, including the NIOSH standards. This is a very different statute than the court has had before it.
I'm sorry, you're turning NIOSH into a promulgator of standards.
Into
the
a
last sentence you appeared to be.
Into a partner in the promulgation of standards that is subject to review under the express review provisions of this statute. It is a partner. It's a direct party. And in fact, the court couldn't grant relief that would be meaningful unless it took jurisdiction on both sides of this fence. If it only granted relief on the MSHA side, it wouldn't address the NIOSH failure for 20 years to release this evidence. The need for transparency.
Suppose we're persuaded by your merits argument. We could vacate the OMSHA rule until adequate research was revealed to support it. But we can't We obviously can't do that because of the Kennicott decision, but on a set of facts where NIOSH's failure were controlling, we could do that.
NIOSH's,
is that a perfectly good remedy?
NIOSH's failure is controlling in this case. The joint appendix at 268 expressly includes some of the provisions of the protocol where they address this conversion of EC to TC with thousands of samples, multiple sets of data, and that material has not been released. So the very underlying issue of how they're going to convert this standard is addressed by this protocol and this study. That data is withheld by NIOSH, refusing to allow transparency, violating the provisions of the Mine Act. This is not discretionary. It's mandatory under this statute. This is a different scheme than the court has reviewed before. Every provision of 811, including the mandatory duties of NIOSH and the right to review and the jurisdiction in this court, not only allows but requires us to bring this. And the fact that meaningful relief cannot be obtained without reviewing both NIOSH and MSHA's actions, we hope argues to this court that it should take this challenge to both actions and form a remedy that finally gives transparency and forces the good science to come out and the data to come out so we can end this dispute based on millions of dollars of effort, incredible sacrifices by the industry and the miners and the people involved. There were thousands upon thousands of people involved in this effort, and that data is being withheld.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cheyenne.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for MSHA?
May it please the court, I'm Edward Seeger. I'm going to be speaking for 15 minutes on behalf of MSHA and the Secretary of Labor. Mr. Schultz is going to be speaking for 5 minutes on behalf of NIOSH and HHS. The steelworkers support the government's position here, but they're not participating. This case is basically a collateral attack on this court's decision in the Kennicott. Both the National Mining Association and MARG are collaterally attacking the 160 total carbon limit that this court upheld, and MARG wants to go further and attack the risk assessment. Counsel for MARG has said that the challenge that they're raising to the NIOSH study relates to the issue of the conversion from total carbon to elemental carbon. That's completely false. The issue in the NIOSH study concerns the risk assessment, whether there's adverse health effects from exposure to diesel particulate matter. The fact that the study is using elemental carbon is totally irrelevant because MSHA explained as long ago as 2001 that there are multiple permissible methods to sample for diesel particulate matter at the high levels that you examine when you're looking for health effects. When you get down to the enforcement issues, though, you have to be much more specific, and that's why you're limited in the methods you can use. Specifically here, as the court held in Kennicott, there are two methods. Either one is permissible. It's total carbon or elemental carbon.
You accept the proposition that the Kennicott decision rejected a facial attack only so that...
No, Your Honor, we do not accept that.
No.
Under the Mine Act, and this is Section 811D, 30 U.S.C. 811D, the pre-enforcement challenge to a standard issued by MSHA is the exclusive way to review that standard. So once this court in Kennicott upheld the standard, that's it. They can't review it again. Now, there are some things that
nothing that develops in the application be attacked?
There are some things in the application. This court in Kennicott upheld the feasibility industry-wide. If there's a specific feasibility problem with a particular mine, then that can be challenged. Just
that sounds like an as-applied challenge.
That's correct. It's not the same thing.
So that remains.
Pardon me?
So that remains.
Yes, on that limited basis. And as we also said in our brief, that MSHA is going to be citing.
Can we unravel this then? Why was the answer to my first question negative? You appeared to be saying that as applied challenges were also precluded.
I think that's right. That the challenge that can be made in an enforcement proceeding is mine specific to the feasibility. They can't go in and say industry wide that the standard
application specific to use the same word that we use as applied.
I'm sorry. Let's leave it at that. It's just a more specific challenge has to be made in the enforcement proceeding. Now, what they can do in the enforcement proceeding also that's relevant to the total carbon, elemental carbon issue is that if they think that MSHA has some problem proving that a total carbon sample results from diesel particulate matter rather than from interferences, they can challenge in the enforcement proceeding, you know, how MSHA arrived at that conclusion. The program policy letter here sets out the method that MSHA said it intends to use to prove in an enforcement proceeding that the sample does result from diesel particulate matter rather than from contamination or contaminants. And this is one of the methods that the MSHA explained in the Kennecott decision that was available to MSHA. It basically means that MSHA takes samples or determines what the ratio is between the elemental carbon portion, which is not subject to contamination, and then the organic portion on top of it, which is, and then compares that with the actual samples. So we think that's a legitimate reason for MSHA to be able to enforce the 160 limit. It's also an issue that they can raise in the enforcement proceedings, and the court doesn't have to address that here.
Why is part two of your brief there? Part two is all about notice and comment rulemaking, not applying.
Yes, we understood that that was something that industry was trying to raise. They said it in their statement of issues, and I guess it's somewhat unclear what exactly, how specifically
they were. What I was looking for was something in your brief that indicated somewhere that it had been raised, but, you know, citing their brief. But you address it, I'm not saying you were required to do this, but since we couldn't find it in the blue brief,
maybe it's just out of abundance of caution that we thought that might be something the court was addressing, and for sake of completeness, we raised it. The point that we wanted to make on the notice and comment issue is that this is something that should be raised in the enforcement proceedings.
I understand that, and that's your argument that these concerns about the program policy letter can be raised during the enforcement process. But I guess your argument is that the standard and whatever appears in the letter as to how you are going to determine whether at a particular mine the standard is being met is totally separate from the standard itself, and therefore no notice and comment.
That's right, Your Honor. The test.
Can that possibly be true? I mean, I suppose you put the PPL into the original rule, the original standard. It would have belonged there, right?
It wouldn't necessarily belong there. The reason MSHA did not do that is because MSHA's got a number of options.
I understand, but isn't one of those options to put the details of the way in which it works out on the ground into the standard?
It works
would be somehow rather reversible if you'd put that into the standard?
I don't think that would have really been necessary because...
I'm not saying it would have been necessary. No. What I'm saying is there any way in which that would have been inappropriate?
Yes, it would have been inappropriate because it would have restricted MSHA's enforcement discretion.
The standard restrict MSHA's enforcement discretion.
Yes, but the standard
can't enforce a non-existent standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the
rules are actually intended to restrict people's discretion.
I understand, Your Honor. What we're saying here is that if MSHA had not issued this program policy letter, which it was not required to do, the standard would have been in effect. It would have been enforceable. The only difference would have been that industry would not have known in advance how MSHA intended to prove that a total carbon sample is not subject to contamination in those subset of cases where it would be necessary to do so. And the result there would have been worse than if, you know, MSHA had, you know, which MSHA did issue the program policy letter, because it would have meant that the operators would have received less notice than they're receiving now. And it would have meant that if they wanted to find out how MSHA wanted to enforce the standard, they'd have to litigate the issue, and that would mean more litigation.
Does that
for
make
both.
It different from Appalachian Power, which you don't cite?
I think it does, Your Honor. And
you might have bothered to distinguish it in your brief.
No, we didn't, Your Honor. And I guess the reason, as I said, is that we think that this really doesn't have the effects on the industry or on MSHA that, you know, the effects were present in Appalachian Power. I'd like just briefly to turn also to...
Wait, I have one more question about that. You said that... you said when you answered Judge Williams' question about why this wasn't put in the original notice, you said because the agency didn't want to limit itself, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and you say in your brief that you say the PPL does not restrict the agency's discretion to select another enforcement method.
That's correct.
In the future. Well, what about, could the agency select a different enforcement method without withdrawing the PPL?
I think it probably could if there was some.
So you mean if, we'll finish your sentence.
Yeah, if there's some reason, you know, when MSHA does an inspection of mine, I'm not sure exactly what that would be, where the inspector finds that this, you know, particular method is not appropriate, then the inspector could use another method.
Why does this PPL say shall?
It's to provide a direction to the inspector so that they know that this is normally what they should be doing.
But it doesn't say they shall do this unless it's... turns out to be an inappropriate situation in which to do it. It says shall.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the way this court's approached similar issues in determining whether something's subject to notice and comment rulemaking is to look at the document as a whole. Right. And here the document says it's a policy, and it also says it involves enforcement discretion.
Yeah, actually, that was precisely true in Appalachian Power. Court was somewhat scornful of the way in which the agency had batted the label around.
Well, that's a valid point.
Other than the use of the word policy, where would I find in this letter if I were a mine operator, where would I find in here an explanation that the protocol described here shall be used unless the circumstances aren't appropriate?
I don't believe that there is.
It's not there, is it?
That's correct. And, and again, the reason that I'm saying that is that it involves an area of enforcement.
Is it what?
It involves an area of enforcement, you know, how an agency is going to enforce a rule which is effective under its own terms. We're an area where
right,
the agency
normally.
Right, but
the question is whether the agency's bound itself to use that protocol.
Yes.
Because if it did, then it would require notice and comment, wouldn't it?
If the agency had actually bound itself to continue using that.
You agree it would, right?
It probably would be subject to that.
Even if it called it a policy.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could just make, you know, the point I think I tried to make earlier is that if the court were to hold that these things are subject to notice and comment rulemaking, that would not be a good result for either MSHA or the industry.
It wouldn't be what?
It would not be a good result for either MSHA or the industry. MSHA is not required to give advance notice of how it intends to, you know, enforce a rule. If the court held that notice and comment rulemaking was required, MSHA would probably say, we really can't do that. Notice and comment rulemaking takes too long.
Well, and therefore, Judge Tatel was suggesting.
Pardon me?
The letter could say this shall apply unless an inspector at a particular mine finds it doesn't work, in which case the inspector shall contact headquarters and get further instructions.
Your Honor, that's correct, but I think that's probably more of a form over substance.
I understand that.
Right. And the problem, as I said earlier, would be that the industry wouldn't have as much notice as they have now, and there'd be more litigation. If the court has any further questions.
Now that's a ubiquitous argument for in the question of whether notice and comment rulemaking is required, with the single exception of norms that can't, that can be enforced, that cannot be enforced in the absence of a legislative rule. Parties would be better off, are better off having the information, and the agency may stop giving the information.
That's probably true. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
No, I'm done.
Mr. Schultz?
Thank you, Your Honor. Benjamin Schultz on behalf of respondents HHS and NIOSH. Section 811D of the Mine Act is a carefully circumscribed provision. It gives this court jurisdiction to review a health or safety standard promulgated by MSHA, and it says that on the petition for review, someone can challenge the validity of that health or safety standard, and they can obtain judicial review of such standard. We submit, Your Honor, that it's clear from this provision that the only proper respondent to such a petition for review would be MSHA or its parent, the Department of Labor. And for that reason, Your Honor, this court lacks jurisdiction over the claims against HHS and NIOSH. Now, Petitioner Marg has tried to bring some sort of track claim, notwithstanding the fact that its petition for review doesn't give any indication that it's actually a petition for mandamus. And for the reasons expressed in our brief, the fact that this court doesn't review the NIOSH study is exactly why this court also doesn't have jurisdiction to review any sort of track claim to compel publication of the NIOSH study. So at that point, Your Honor, all that's left is Marg's claim that this court should take some sort of ancillary jurisdiction over the claims against HHS and NIOSH. And for the reasons expressed in our brief, that narrow exception to the general rule that this court only has appellate jurisdiction when a specific statute authorizes it.
When will this study be released? Do we know?
Your Honor, we don't have a clear date yet. It turns out that data collection took much longer than anyone anticipated, but we're hopeful that it will be released in a reasonable amount of time. There are no
further... Your position is there's no... Take it the agency's position is that there's no way... either this court or any other court could compel to be released. There's just no jurisdiction to do that.
Your Honor, we don't believe this court has jurisdiction.
No, I understand your argument.
I suppose that a district
court. What about the district court under
a district court,
APA action or something?
A district court might have 1331 jurisdiction, but we don't believe that Marg could state a claim on which relief could be granted because there would be no final agency action to compel.
But the TRAC undercuts that, right? TRAC creates finality through undue delay.
Well, Your Honor, I think the premise of TRAC is that what you're trying to compel is final agency action, and publication of the NIOSH study would not in itself be final agency action even when the study is completed. So in that sense, there's nothing to compel because what you ultimately get is still not reviewable. There are no further questions. We'll rest on our brief.
Thank you. Counsel for NMA. All
right. We had assigned rebuttal
that's fine.
For our side to do it, if that's okay with the court. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first address the question of the PPL, which we challenged directly in our petition for review specifically and expressly. In our opening brief, we argue that rulemaking is necessary. In our reply brief, we address Appalachian Power at length. And I can tell this court that over the course of the last 12 months in the year 2009, the Mine Safety and Health Administration has issued approximately 70 violations for this rule under its program policy as set forth in its website report. That's 70 times. that companies, and there are only 150 or so companies subject to this rule that operate underground mines, approximately half the population, it appears, has been cited under the PPL. The PPL changes this rule in very, very extreme ways. It makes the rights and duties of the parties different.
Your co-counsel pointed me to footnote 7 of his brief for supposedly raising the notice and comment claim vis-a-vis the PPL. Where is it that your brief raises this? Well, please don't refer me to your petition.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Please don't refer me to your petition for review.
In our opening brief, we discuss mandatory rulemaking prior to agency decisions to repeal or amend rules at page 31. We do not expressly associate it with Appalachian Power, but we discuss Appalachian Power in our reply. But we do talk about APA mandatory rulemaking, notice and comment.
I mean, the focus of that passage is entirely the joint decisions to not institute the theorized rulemaking and to let the existing rules take effect.
Well,
and you, for those you encounter I-Corps and similar.
We argue, I believe, Your Honor, that the existing rule did not take effect. In fact, what they did
I understand, but so far as the PPL is concerned, you still haven't called my attention to any passage on that.
I don't think we did a good enough job of specifically tying the arguments together, but we made the argument that rulemaking mandates were violated by these series of actions. Sure. And that no notice and comment took place. They did change the rights and duties of the parties. There's no question. We, the mine operators, are required to take samples to assure compliance. We don't even know now where to take the sample, because if you look at the PPL, it orders us to take them at some place outside of the person's lapel. It's no longer a personal sample. We now have these additional. That is a direct change in our duty of what we have to do. It also changes the substance of what is being measured. They're not measuring the single sample for carbon. They're measuring some other sample for other things. So they're changing the regulatory standard that says a single sample for total carbon cannot be 160 total carbon or more. Every part of that has been changed by the PPL and the rulemaking that took place without notice and comment.
See, when I was reading the briefs, I thought industry might be making an argument that basically it was relying on the agency's promise to make this conversion, and therefore its planning, its technology, all these things had been designed and implemented on these assumptions. And now the agency changes its mind. All right? I didn't see that. And this argument that once there's a standard, and everybody's clear this is the standard, the fact that the agency says we have a study that tells us four different ways we might measure this, and it gives you that information, that somehow it's changing the standard. I understand your point about you may have to, or your clients may have to take, or your members may have to take samples at different locations. But the standard is the same, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The standard has been changed because it's no longer the total carbon in the sample on a person, a personal exposure for total carbon, that is determining compliance. It's now another sample taken somewhere else in the mine that is determining compliance or not compliance, and we have to guess where the somewhere else is under the program policy language.
If there's an actual contradiction as opposed to an amplification, then that would sound like an argument that could be raised in an enforcement proceeding and as described by you, successfully raised.
I'm sure that we would be met with no collateral attack in an enforcement proceeding on the validity of the standard, which is prohibited by the statute.
You'd be invoking the validity of the standard and attacking the contradictory application of the standard.
I mean, I listen to counsel for the secretary, and I don't think that
I listen too.
Your Honor, I do want to point out one thing that the because it is bothering me tremendously. The protocol for this NIOSH study says mine-specific and overall correlation coefficients will be estimated for all direct surrogates, and there are 12, including elemental and all the carbon. So they have thousands of data points on this very issue and incredible amounts of data that has not been released. So for my opponents to say that it has nothing to do with this case is just completely wrong. It has everything to do with how you measure and then how you take those measurements and relate them to whether or not health effects exist at these levels. This is a critical piece of work, and we beg this court to solve this problem and resolve it in its entirety by ordering MSHA to open the rulemaking and by having NIOSH put the study data and release it as they've been ordered to do in prior court proceedings. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're not going to argue? All right, thank you. We will take the case under advisement.